Welcome to The Roundup, a North Queensland-based podcast with regional content for regional clinicians. I'm Alyssa Hatherley, a GP and family planning clinician and head of JCU's clinical school here in Mackay. This collaborative podcasting project between North Queensland Regional Training Hubs, JCU, and our local, regional, hospital and health services will bring you a different regionally relevant podcast each fortnight. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands where we meet today, who were the original providers of healthcare in this region. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Anna Cormond, a rheumatology registrar in Cairns. We're really excited to have you back today, Anna. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again. Like I said, you'll make my mum very happy. I'm famous now.
Our mums are often our greatest supporters, aren't they? We wanted to have a chat about psoriatic arthritis. Anna, as a registrar, I'm wondering if you had any idea the incidence or prevalence of psoriatic arthritis when you started your training. It affects many more people than we really appreciate, I think, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think when we're learning about it in basic training before rheumatology advanced training, you get this idea that it can be anywhere from 10 to 15% of the general population. But obviously being in the rheumatology clinic, it seems even higher than that because it makes up such a large proportion of our referrals. And I would say probably about 40% of the referrals we get actually have psoriatic arthritis. So that's why I thought it would be a good topic to maybe help in the GP setting kind of weed out what needs to be referred or what may be like a bum steer and not actually psoriatic arthritis.
So when you say 40% of referrals are actually psoriatic arthritis, are they referrals for review of patients with presumed psoriatic arthritis, of which only 40% actually have psoriatic arthritis? Or is that 40% of all of the referrals that come into your clinic?
40% of the ones that get referred with the question of could this be psoriatic arthritis seem to actually have psoriatic arthritis. I think it's great that GPs think of it because if it's missed, psoriatic arthritis can actually be more destructive and erosive than rheumatoid. And so especially when you're dealing with quite often a young patient cohort, you can have significant joint damage and deformities within the first 3 to 5 years. So I don't mind at all them being referred as they are. I think it's great that everyone thinks about it, but just some tips and things that might save some of the referrals when realistically, depending on their age, their clinical picture and their symptom pattern, don't have an inflammatory pathology.
So for those of our patients who do suffer with psoriasis and might have arthritic symptoms, how are we best going to define whether it's a psoriatic arthritis or a different process altogether?
I think one of the first things is risk stratifying them before you even get into the joint history. The general risk of psoriatic arthritis in someone who has psoriasis is about 15 to 20% lifelong risk. Then if you add in that they have scalp involvement, that goes to a 30 to 40% risk that they'll develop inflammatory arthritis. And if they've got scalp and nail involvement, you're sitting comfortably around a 40% lifetime risk. So having an idea of what sort of psoriasis they have can kind of help with how suspicious you'd be about a psoriatic arthritis pattern.
Right.
That would be where I'd start with. And you might have a guy in his 20s who's got terrible scalp psoriasis, that leukonychia or onycholysis, lifting dodgy looking nails. And then they start to come complaining about an oligoarthritis. So they've got knees and ankles. That's when I would be pretty suspicious on a pretest probability that that person's going to have psoriatic arthritis. I guess to kind of contrast that with some of the other referrals or the other patients we see who might be a gentleman in his 70s, who's got a slightly sore MCPs or wrists, who's got a mild bit of what probably more so looks like eczema. And it's debated whether or not it's been psoriasis their whole life, and they get referred in as well. So just to kind of give you the contrast of the spectrum of who you're very suspicious of and who you're really not sus on at all.
When we have those patients who we're really suspicious of, I think the urgency of getting them into a specialist is incredibly high and our resources are limited. How are we going to be of best assistance to our patients while they're waiting for a rheumatology review?
Good question. I think it's tricky because it depends a lot on the rheumatologist as to how comfortable they are with treatment being initiated in the community setting. First thing would be to get advice from a rheumatology service, even if over the phone, when you start to suspect that they've got the inflammatory pathologies. I do get a lot of calls from GPs all around Queensland just saying, I think this is what I've got. And we'll talk through their inflammatory markers, what joints are involved, a bit of the history. And in a lot of those patients, I would happily start a course of prednisone with a weaning schedule, and then I'll look at when I can fit them in. From a patient advocacy point of view, trying to seek out that advice from any rheumatology AT over the phone, even if they're not the one in your local area because they've gone on leave or gone on a glamorous holiday, can still be helpful. So that would probably be the biggest thing, is to seek the advice early, especially about initiating some prednisone dosing. Things like other DMARDs, we're pretty much always going to want to see the patient before we do anything like that, just because it's really hard to trust an assessment over the phone for something as heavy as starting methotrexate. And it's not really fair to put that back on the GPs either, I don't think.
With telehealth, though, when you can actually see the patient over the screen, does that help a little bit sometimes, or are you still a little bit nervous about commencing the patients on DMARDs in that circumstance when there's no other great option?
If there's no other great option, I'm all for telehealth. I think especially living where we are, so obviously I'm based in Cairns and you're based in Mackay. Telehealth is just something that we have to utilize. And for a lot of our patients from Cairns or from Torres Strait Islands, and in that case, we use telehealth a lot, or some of the remote communities, we use it in Aurukun a lot. And in that instance, I would be comfortable, because pragmatically, if there's not a better option, you're not realistically going to be seeing that person in front of you in the next 6 to 8 weeks. You should be starting some therapy. So I would be comfortable doing it over telehealth if I couldn't easily get them down to clinic.
In a community setting, or with a patient who comes into the emergency department and they have an oligoarthritis, what are we looking for in terms of the psoriatic arthritis for signs?
If someone was to present and you were sort of working them up for psoriatic arthritis, I think what I'd look for is, you know, how many joints are involved and whether it's symmetrical or asymmetrical. So like you mentioned, psoriatic arthritis tends to be more of a medium joint oligoarthritis, although not exclusively. Like, it does affect your PIPs and MCPs, but we can see in the beginning phase a lot more knees, ankles, elbow involvement than you do rheumatoid, and a lot more asymmetrical. One of the things that's really helpful to establish, whether that's in the GP setting or the emergency setting, is whether they've got enthesitis or dactylitis. So a great thing that you can do for your patients is to get them to take photos if they think they've got swollen digits. So someone saying that their finger looks swollen versus coming in with a photo that shows you dactylitis can be the difference between diagnosing them for psoriatic arthritis or monitoring them for another 6 months. So I think as a their practitioner, encouraging them to photograph weird swollen joints is really helpful. The things that will kind of help move it along is just looking at nail changes, feeling around the Achilles tendon, whether it's boggy or squishy, or they've got that enthesitis there, and trying to do, I'm sort of jumping between exam history and investigations here, so sorry about that. But this is sort of just a cook's tour of trying to get a snapshot if someone's got psoriatic arthritis or not. But that would be where I'd look at their joint distribution, look if they have any skin changes, look if they have any nail changes, and look if they've got dactylitis or enthesitis. Because if they've got the tendinopathies related to it, then you're going down a completely different pathway than you would like rheumatoid or reactive. I think probably a lot of GPs know about the CASPER criteria as well.
Maybe just talk us through that again, please, Anna.
Sure. It's easily accessible on MedCalc. I love MedCalc, still use it all the time for creatinine clearance. But it just starts out with, do you think that they have an inflammatory articular disease? So that includes joint, spine, or enthesial. So if you have a patient that comes to you complaining of what you think might be inflammatory lower back pain, and then they've had some swollen Achilles tendon, that's enough to say yes to that question. So it's pretty loose as the entry criteria into the rest of the criteria. And then it kind of goes through, you have to have 3 or more points from 5 major categories. So the first one is whether or not they themselves have skin psoriasis or they have a family history of psoriasis. And so that includes scalp changes and a little bit debated whether you can include nails in there, but it's its own separate criteria anyway, so it doesn't matter. But do they have psoriasis and does their family member have psoriasis? So that's the point. Then you go on to, do they have any nail changes of psoriasis? So that includes onycholysis, pitting, or that really thick, hyperkeratotic, chunky nails. Then you go on to whether or not they've already had a rheumatoid factor checked. So obviously wanting that to be negative. And that's next part is whether they've had dactylitis. It says current dactylitis in the actual criteria, but if you've seen an episode in the past, we always give that a point. The last one most people kind of ignore because it says juxta-articular new bone formation. You never really see that. You tend to see erosions or you'll see swelling on an MRI, but juxta-articular bone formation is when their hands are kind of already quite deformed and inflamed. So if you hadn't diagnosed it by that point, you really don't need that point in the criteria. But it can be helpful if you're trying to tip them over the line for research purposes.
My gosh, Anna, we've talked about so much already.
If you had a patient who comes to you and you think they might have psoriatic arthritis, the dot pointed things that I would do as a GP, I guess, is what would be the helpful things to kind of talk about here. And in that case, I would check the rheumatoid factor, get them to take photos if they have sausage fingers or sausage toes, pay attention to if they've got scalp or nail involvement and ask them a family history and include a lower back pain history and a family history in that initial referral. Because if it's a triaging purpose and you're trying to get them seen earlier, if they have in their referral, blah, blah, has a family history of psoriatic arthritis, they've got scalp involvement, they've had an episode of dactylitis that I've seen in clinic, their rheumatoid factor is negative and their CCP is 12, then before they even get there, I would probably categorize them as a one and bring them in soon to try and get them onto treatment.
Wow. I think that was a fantastic summary of the approach to psoriatic arthritis, Anna, which is so incredibly complicated. So can we just talk through the lower back pain that you mentioned? How is that going to change your positive predictive value or how urgently you're going to see the patient?
Yeah. So if they were a patient who was less than 40 or they were in their 50s with an onset of back pain before 40, I would be thinking a lot about your ankylosing spondylitis or your spondyloarthropathy spectrum, which we know overlaps a lot with psoriatic arthritis. And I feel like that's sometimes a really complicated umbrella term when people say spondyloarthropathies, but I always chuck them in the same basket of history taking when I see someone who's had an onset of back pain before age 40. It's all in the same epitopes of the HLA-B27 positivities and those sorts of things. But basically, if they've got a stiff lower back that started before they were age of 40 and it's NSAID responsive and improves with movement, plus they've then had some Achilles tendonitis and some psoriasis on their scalp, that's the perfect picture for a psoriasis-associated spondyloarthropathy. But in that bracket, I will also check in, have you ever had a red-hot angry eye for uveitis? Have you ever had blood or mucus in your stool for inflammatory bowel disease? Have you recently been treated for chlamydia or gonorrhea or had any bad gastro infections recently for reactive arthritis? And then that kind of helps me stratify them as you don't necessarily have to fit one diagnosis, but you're in that realm of the spondyloarthropathies. And those are people that we also see sooner rather than later and put under closer surveillance if they've got those risk factors that overlap.
And I think how our chat today has evolved, Anna, really reflects how these diagnoses develop in the real world. Don't you are not taking a history and then examining and then investigating. You're often doing all three at the same time, and it's a real evolution and might be over many weeks or many months, or even, as you say, it can be over years before we really sort out the patients properly and get them into the treatment that they need.
It's a very chaotic assessment for sure. And I think for the patients that we're seeing in clinic who, you know, maybe they just have a sore lower back or maybe they've just had like a monoarthritis of the knee, one other clue, it's often just following things down a rabbit hole for us. And I think it depends on how forthcoming the patient is with their history. Some people will come in and just dump all of the information on you and you know their diagnosis right away. But I think with the spondyloarthropathy umbrella, it's just about following clues. So if they've come to see you and they've had UV, then they'd be doing their B27 and asking them about psoriasis and asking about this and that. So I think it can sort of be done as well in the general practitioner setting, but obviously it's about knowing what rabbit hole to follow, because otherwise you'd be there literally all day and you guys do not have that time to do that.
Nobody does. All right. So we've got a patient who we suspect has psoriatic arthritis. You've confirmed it and are thinking about their treatment. If we have commenced treatment in the general practice setting or in another outpatient setting, it might be a weaning dose of prednisone to help make the patient a bit more comfortable before they get onto their DMARD, their disease modifying agent. Mm-hmm. What is your first point of call now as a rheumatologist, and what are the emerging therapies that we need to become conversant with?
In terms of treatment, one of the things just to mention with the prednisone is that it's worth cautioning the patients that prednisone will worsen bad skin psoriasis too. So I always give them a heads up that the joints will feel great, but the skin might play up a lot.
And that's a temporary thing.
I know, you're trading one evil for another, but flaky skin versus nice smooth joints, I'd take the joints. It will flare most skin psoriasis, so I warn them about that. In terms of therapies, you can pick one of the three main DMARDs when we start patients. So obviously biologics are growing, and accessibility to biologics and biosimilars is going to ultimately be the future of what we start people on, and eventually skip a few DMARDs if we can. But at the moment, methotrexate, leflunomide or sulfasalazine are our main therapies that we'd start on, one of the three. Methotrexate was the favoured one, particularly with dermatology because of the improvement in skin. So that often still gets used as first line because it helps the skin and the joints. But there is some data to suggest that leflunomide and sulfasalazine are actually more effective for bad arthritic disease. It depends. If they have mild skin but bad joints, we'd typically go leflunomide or sulfasalazine. Whereas if they have horrible skin and not terrible joints or not as bad joints, we might start with methotrexate, and you can always add sulfasalazine to that mix later on. Normally within 3 months, escalate treatment for psoriatic arthritis and be seeing them pretty quickly to try and get them into remission to prevent that erosive joint damage.
Right. What sort of treatments do we have on the horizon, do you think?
So I think a lot of the future for psoriatic arthritis is going to be in the IL-17s, the IL-12-23s and the IL-23s, so all of the biologics. We block nearly every interleukin we can find nowadays, so that's what all of those numbers are for. But guselkumab is a 23 blockade that's good for horrible skin disease, and sometimes that works really well for their joints too. Secukinumab at the moment is a really popular biologic that we use, but also good old-fashioned TNFs. So there's still a lot of use of adalimumab in the skin psoriatic bracket, but the thing about TNFs is sometimes that can make their skin worse, or you can get TNF-induced psoriasis. So a lot of the times there isn't a perfect one biologic fits all for a disease process, and we tend to change therapy at least once or twice in the beginning. But I think the future for psoriasis is going to be early escalation to biologic therapy, especially in the younger cohort. And that'll normally be an anti-TNF or an IL-17 blocker.
What about the lifestyle changes that the patients might undertake to try and improve their psoriasis or their psoriatic arthritis? Everyone has Googled, got some tips about taking some turmeric or reducing their caffeine and changing their inflammatory markers with their dietary modifications. Is there any evidence that there's anything that the patients might usefully trial?
So I've seen some weird things with diets that people have done for rheumatoid or psoriatic, and I think it always comes back to very sensible stuff. So smoking is definitely the worst thing you can do for your skin and your joints, and that includes rheumatoid or psoriatic. So I'd normally explain to them that smoking cessation won't just help with the skin, but also the joints and also your risk of joint destruction and fractures and osteoporosis. I always spend some time talking about that if they're a smoker. The other things is sun safety too, UV exposure. I know we use UV for severe plaque psoriasis, but that's a controlled dosage of UV by the dermatology team. So I normally say sun safety is another big priority for skin and joint related problems. That's true in lupus and it's true in a lot of inflammatory joint problems. Diet-wise, I don't have any specific advice apart from eating healthy and not too much alcohol. And I think anecdotally, I do see a lot of patients who will mention that they went gluten-free and their joint symptoms improved, or they went, you know, vegetarian or dairy-free. And I certainly think that there is mounting evidence in terms of the gut microbiome or the gut health and its relationship to autoimmune disease activity. And that's getting massive, massive amounts of attention in the literature. but nothing specific enough to tell someone what to eat and not to eat. So when patients ask me the specific question of should they change their diet, I say, is there anything you typically don't tolerate or that you notice makes your joint symptoms worse? If so, you can cut that one out. For some patients, they'll say, oh, I think I'm celiac, but I've never had it tested. But when I eat it, I get bloated and my joints are sore. And certainly cutting that out, we know the relationship between autoimmunity, celiac, lymphomas, joint pathologies is all tied in there. I do think that actually does improve their symptom burden. I just don't know it enough to make it sort of formal advice across the board.
Yeah, right. So that would then go speak to my next question, which is about prevention. So we know that those patients with psoriasis, not all of them will develop psoriatic arthritis. Those of us who've drawn the short straw in terms of our HLA-B27 genetic profile and all those other HLAs that are implicated, should those patients be counselled about different things to help prevent the development of the arthritis?
At this point, there isn't anything known that is preventative for the development of arthritis apart from avoiding smoking. And even then, that's more rheumatoid than it is psoriatic. The way I explain it is it's in your blueprints and typically there's nothing you did wrong to bring it on. It was just going to be a matter of time. So there's nothing that they can really modify apart from living a generally healthy lifestyle that would steer the course, unfortunately.
And I'm thinking about everything that we've talked about in this slightly chaotic conversation about psoriatic arthritis. What would be the top take-home messages for clinicians meeting these patients on the front line in whatever the setting is to really be of most value to our patients?
I would say the top few things that would be helpful would be, number one, never stop referring, because I'd much rather see someone and say they don't have psoriatic arthritis than someone not be referred and miss out on that early joint destruction. So please keep it up and I'm all for it if you're not sure. Number two would be you can talk to any room AT anywhere. If you can't get in contact with your local one, talk to someone else. And we're always happy to give you a few things to move things along, whether that's testing their rheumatoid factor, doing an ultrasound of their Achilles, repeating their CRP or starting some PRED. So feel comfortable to reach out, especially in the younger patient cohort where their joints can be very early destroyed, basically. And I think the third thing would be maybe what I don't see happen a lot is paying a lot of attention to patients' family history and the psoriasis distribution, as including that in referrals definitely helps with categorizing them higher up in terms of our index of suspicion.
Yeah, so that young patient, particularly with scalp involvement, with slightly dodgy looking nails.
Dodgy. The thick hyperkeratotic nails, you know, the nails from hell where they're thick and they're lifted and they're pale. Dodgy nails, young patient, scalp involvement and biggish joint involvement, knees and elbows. That's when I'd be extra sus.
All right. So we're going to pick up the phone, talk to a rheumatologist, our local rheumatologist, or as you say, Anna, any rheumatologist, make sure we're doing those investigations and getting some prednisone into that patient, even though it might flare their skin initially, just to help get those joint symptoms under control. And then look out for those other disease modifying agents, whether it's the methotrexate, the sulfasalazine, the new biologics, those fancy IL blockers or TNF alpha blockers. It sounds like there are many more and useful treatment options available for our psoriatic arthritis patients than there ever have been before, which is great news.
Definitely. And I think the only thing I'd really add to that is, you know, MRIs are expensive if they're not being requested in the right setting. Like say when we request them, I think so they're partially bulk billed, but they can be quite pricey from the general practitioner setting. So ultrasounds are still really helpful in psoriatic arthritis if it can capture an episode of tendonitis or plantar fasciitis. Sometimes we use that to help us decide too. Of all the imaging modalities, if you were going to do a baseline x-ray, ultrasounding something that you think looks tender or swollen can be really, really useful for us to have that to capture an acute flare. So that would be my last tidbit.
Oh, we love your top tips, Anna. Thank you so much for talking to us today about psoriatic arthritis. Hopefully, we will find an increase in referrals for you and your colleagues across North Queensland. Dr. Anna Cormond in Cairns, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Alyssa.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.